It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here.
Please join me in a spirit of prayer. May our dark places begin to see the light. May the large and small deaths we have endured release their grip on us so that we may return to life. May the apprehension which has stifled us give way to hope and trust. May all those who have suffered know they have suffered enough and that it is time to reclaim their dreams and their courage. There are two kinds of people in life, those who are alive and those who are afraid. Now it is Easter. It is time to come back to life in our hearts, our lives, and our relationships. The night has lasted long enough. It is Easter. Let us reclaim our lives. Amen. This is the third in a series of sermons on the most dangerous fundamentalism on earth, which is a pretty serious subject, but it's also Easter Sunday. It's Easter Sunday in the traditions of Christianity, florists, restaurants, and those who hunt for Easter eggs. So I want to honor the seriousness of the first subject and the optimism of the second, a feat that might sound like it would have to involve a miracle. The story of Easter is the Christian version of a universal story of our hope that somehow death isn't the last word, negating the significance of our lives. Hindus had addressed this a few centuries earlier through their metaphor of reincarnation. And you know the even older Egyptian myth of the phoenix rising from its own ashes. It's one of our very oldest hopes. Religious liberals usually see these stories, and religious biblical scholars see these stories, as I also do, as metaphors about psychological sorts of resurrection, or about the hope that life doesn't have to kill your spirit or the spirit of love or hope or the spirit of a people. Liberal biblical scholars talk about the resurrection this way too. The crucifixion I'll talk about, however, is all too real. It has involved and continues to involve the real deaths of millions of people, the destruction of economies and societies, and the murder of hope right here in our real world. That's the story of the most dangerous fundamentalism on earth, what author Naomi Klein calls the capitalist fundamentalism of the past 36 years, centered in Milton Friedman and the University of Chicago School of Economics, also called the Chicago School or the Chicago Boys. It made its dramatic entry on September 11th, 1973, when, with the backing of our CIA, the brutal General Pinochet murdered the democratically elected President Salvador Allende in Chile and unleashed a reign of robbery and terror from which the majority in Chile have never recovered. By the 1980s, a sophisticated and coordinated plan for repeating all this had been pretty much perfected. First, they were aware and ready when a crisis happened or could be helped to happen, that could adequately paralyze a nation so they could apply what Friedman called their economic shock therapy. Since they had all these plans worked out, it was like having an overnight bag that you could take with you on the next flight out to the latest crisis. It was very fast response. Chicago-trained economists arrived to show those in the power structure how to immediately rewrite the economic structures and laws to remove all obstacles to looting by American and multinational corporations. And this followed a book, a 500-page book they had put together after Pinochet's murder of Allende in 1973. The plan for kidnapping, torturing, terrorizing, and killing citizens who opposed this theft had become standardized following the procedures set out in another book, our CIA interrogation manual known as KUBARC. Put together in 1963, the CIA is still using it as their interrogation manual. It's the book that prescribes the early morning or late night kidnapping, the hooding, beating, sensory deprivation, electroshock, and techniques like waterboarding that we have all heard so much about. It comes from a book. Finally, a strong police or military presence and varying degrees of violence have been necessary every time Friedman's Chicago School economic plans have been put in effect, for obvious reasons. These are plans to loot entire societies, and the majority of people in those societies will not take it if they have the means to resist, especially the workers. The purpose of rewriting the laws, selling off the government assets, destroying workers' unions, social support networks, and bringing in kidnapping, torture, and the rest of it, is to ensure that the people won't have the means or the will to resist. This is all written down in a book. But the violence isn't the point of it. The violence enables the robbery. These are extraordinarily violent armed robberies. These methods have been used in so many countries now. Chile, Uruguay, Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, Africa, Russia, China, Iraq, and others. Some would also add England under Margaret Thatcher and our own country since Reagan. But today I want to talk about only one of these countries where these practices were put into effect, the whole range of practices, Russia. I want to talk only about Russia in order to save time for the resurrection part of the sermon, which is also very real and very serious. The turning of the tide, the things that people around the world have begun to do to counter this economic plan. Russia. Between 1989 and 1991, the old USSR collapsed. This had been our Cold War enemy. The most hawkish voices in and behind our government now believe that we had no rival for power in the world. And we believe no one could stop our greed or our aggression. Just like in a bad movie or video game, we thought we could rule the world. And the real point of ruling the world is money, not bragging rights. This occasion brought about the second September 11th event in this story. On September 11th, 1991, that's when President George H.W. Bush made the speech in which he first introduced the phrase, the New World Order. The New World Order simply meant a world ruled by American corporate interests, since we believe there was no one to stop us. I want to say a few words on this odd date of September 11th, which figures prominently three times in the story. It seems very odd, but I have absolutely no idea how or why it could have been an intentional part of any kind of a huge overall plan. So as far as I can tell, it's just one of the strange coincidences of history. When Russia's new president, Boris Yeltsin, came to the World Bank and the IMF for help the month after Bush's speech. They responded with this economic plan designed to destroy the Russian economy and remove all barriers to a feeding frenzy of foreign, mostly American, capitalists looting the Russian economy. On October 28, 1991, Yeltsin announced the lifting of price controls and the Russian economy was on its way to being decimated. I don't think a lot of us followed this story very closely. By the end of that day, his military assault on his own people had taken the lives of about 500 people and wounded almost 1,000. That was the most violence Moscow had seen since the Russian Revolution of 1917. The Chicago boys went on a lawmaking binge, ramming through huge budget cuts, the price hikes on basic food items, including bread, and even more and faster auctioning off of government assets at a mere fraction of their worth. They quickly sold off the country's approximately 225,000 state-owned companies. The average Russian consumed 40% less in 1992 than in 1991, and a third of the population fell below the poverty line. The middle class was forced to sell personal belongings from card tables on the streets. Desperate acts that the Chicago School economist praised as entrepreneurial, a proof that a capitalist renaissance was indeed underway, one family heirloom and secondhand blazer at a time. Now think about this. If you had to sell your possessions in order to eat, is entrepreneurial the word you would choose? Can you feel the indifferent and the brutal spirit of what Naomi Klein is calling this fundamentalist capitalism? Can you see why so much violence was necessary to steal so much from so many people, and why one of Milton Friedman's critics called it economic genocide? Communism may have collapsed without firing a single shot, but this style of capitalism, it turned out, required a great deal of gunfire. Yeltsin called in 5,000 soldiers, dozens of tanks and armored personnel carriers, helicopters and elite shock troops armed with automatic machine guns, all to defend Russia's new capitalist economy from the grave threat of democracy. This word democracy is a very interesting word when it gets used in these stories. And there's a great example of that. From Yeltsin's assistant in charge for auctioning off hundreds of billions of dollars worth of government assets. He was a champion of Pinochet's brutal tactics from Chile. And he said, think of this, in order to have a democracy in society, there must be a dictatorship in power. This is perfect Orwellian 1984 doublespeak. The phrase democracy in society simply means the freedom of corporations to loot the entire economy without restraint. And the dictatorship of power and the terrible violence it unleashed was not seen as an enemy of this kind of democracy. In fact, it was its necessary ally. Because no one planning this ever cared about the rights of workers or anyone else who stood in the way. Human life counted for very little compared to the potential profits at stake. Just like his mentor, Pinochet's, Yeltsin's own family grew very rich. His children and several of their spouses were appointed to top posts at large firms looted from the government. In the absence of a major famine, plague, or battle, never have so many lost so much in so short a time as in Russia. By 1998, more than 80% of Russian farms had gone bankrupt, and roughly 70,000 state factories had closed, creating an epidemic of unemployment. In 1989, before the Chicago School Economic Shock Therapy, 2 million people in the Russian Federation were living in poverty on less than $4 a day. By 1997, 74 million Russians were living below the poverty line, according to the World Bank. That means that the economic reforms imposed on Russia can claim credit for the impoverishment of 72 million people in only 8 years. Nor were these catastrophic results unique to Russia. The entire 35-year history of the Chicago School experiment has been one of mass corruption and violent collusion between police states and large corporations. The point of the economic shock therapy is to open up a window for enormous profits to be made very quickly and to eliminate all effective resistance by whatever means necessary. This is the crucifixion that has gone on for the last 40 to 50 years in countries all over the world, always, it seems, with the backing of our CIA and the involvement of some of our largest corporations and wealthiest individuals. The parallels, and it may not seem that there would be any, but the parallels to the crucifixion of Jesus are surprisingly apt. Many biblical scholars believe that the single event that doomed Jesus was his scene in Jerusalem's huge temple, turning over the money changers' tables, trying to stop them from making an unnecessary profit from the people. It's not a coincidence that the most violent torture, suppression, and murder in every country, from Chile to Russia and others, has been against workers, workers' unions, and the artists and intellectuals who spoke out against the looting, the liberal elements of the society. Popular religion often wants to make Jesus a sweet, pietistic figure who just preached love. But while that message might get someone ignored by authorities, it certainly wouldn't get them killed. In real life, his crucifixion may have had a lot to do with his activism on behalf of the poor and the courageous and sort of astonishing act of going into the major temple and tipping over the money changers' tables. And the resurrection, as liberal Christian scholars understand it, wasn't about a dead man rising and walking again. It meant that after Jesus had died, some of his followers began to believe that he and his message had represented a perspective, a possibility for life, far higher and more life-giving than they could grasp simply by saying he was a really wise man. On the first two Sundays in April, I'll go back to talk about some of the other countries where we've used these methods and the new developments that came up in the tactics for doing so. But I want to spend the rest of our time on the resurrection, on the return to life of some of the devastated countries, how they did it, and what it might have to do with us. The three chief financial institutions that have supported the Chicago-style economic looting have been the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, the World Trade Organization, or WTO, and the World Bank. Naomi Klein believes that all three may now be among the money changers being thrown out of some of the world's temples. The IMF had played a powerful role in helping to destabilize many countries so they could be looted, but eventually people caught on. After 1998, it became very difficult to impose the shock therapy style makeovers through the usual IMF bullying or arm twisting at trade summits. The defiant new mood coming from South America made its global debut when the WTO talks collapsed in Seattle in 1999. You probably remember the news stories about the college-age protesters outside the meeting in Seattle, but that's not where the action was happening. The real rebellion took place inside the conference center where developing countries formed a voting bloc and rejected demands for trade concessions as long as Europe and the United States continued to subsidize and protect all their own domestic industries. That was the real rebellion. Within a few years, the U.S. government's ambitious dream of creating a unified free trade zone encompassing all of Asia-Pacific was abandoned, as were a global investors treaty and plans for a free trade area of the Americas. Remember that the words free trade are code. They refer to a system whereby multinational corporations are allowed free entry into foreign markets while subsidizing many of their own industries back home. So we can destroy, say, the corn industry in Mexico by taking in subsidized corn from America that can be sold for far less than Mexicans can produce their own corn for. It's only free going one direction. Ever since the Argentine collapse in 2001, opposition to foreign looting has become the defining issue of the whole continent, able to make governments and break them. By late 2006, it was practically creating a domino effect. Colombia seems to be the only Latin American country in which we still have some economic control. Latin America's mass movements are also learning how to build shock absorbers into their organizing models. They're organizing differently than they did 40 years ago. They're less centralized than they were in the 60s, making it harder to destroy whole societies by eliminating a few leaders and replacing them with a few people who are willing to sell out their countries in return for enormous wealth and power. The progressive networks in Venezuela are highly decentralized, with power dispersed at the grassroots and community level through thousands of neighborhood councils and co-ops. In Venezuela, Chavez has made the co-ops a top political priority, giving them first refusal on government contracts and offering them economic incentives to trade with each other. By 2006, there were about 100,000 cooperatives in the country, employing more than 700,000 workers. How effective has this been? Is this just feel-good, flowery rhetoric for Easter, or has this actually made any real difference in the world? It's really made a lot of difference. In 2005, Latin America made up 80% of the IMF's total lending portfolio. In 2007, the continent represented only 1%. A sea change in only 2 years. It made a huge difference. The transformation reaches beyond Latin America. In just 3 years, the IMF's worldwide lending portfolio had shrunk from $81 billion to under $12 billion, with almost all of that going to Turkey. Naomi Klein believes that the IMF, a pariah in so many countries now, where it has treated crises as profit-making opportunities, is starting to wither away. The World Bank faces an equally grim future. In the midst of the Wolfowitz affair a while back, the Financial Times reported that now, when World Bank managers dispense advice in the developing world, they are laughed at. That's a sea change. Add the collapse of the World Trade Organization talks in 2006, and the futures of the three main institutions that had imposed the Chicago School ideology look to be at the risk of extinction, at least as Naomi Klein sees it. This may signal the end of an era of American piracy that history will look back on in shame, depending, as always, on who gets to write that history. But as an Easter topic, it's about the difference in the spirits and the gods being served. It's about which ones can bring life. Easter, reincarnation, the Phoenix myth, and all the other resurrection stories are always about the victory of life-giving spirits over smaller and more selfish ones. This looks like it could be the reincarnation of the spirit of life and hope in new bodies and new opportunities throughout Latin America and some other countries. And it looks like the rebirth of the sons and daughters of God, again living with power, dignity, and authority. That's what all religions worthy of the name teach as our sacred rite during our days on this earth. Let us seek and claim them. To all those in Latin America and other recovering countries, and to all of us seeking to survive the large and small deaths in our lives as well, happy Easter.